Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Underserved. This is episode number 100 of the show. Today, instead of featuring the story of one guest, we're going to do a panel interview about the artificial intelligence invasion, specifically how generative AI is going to change software development forever.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Let me introduce our guests for today. Mike Bro is a longtime friend and colleague I've known for over 20 years. Mike is too humble to say so, but I consider him one of the top software developers in the country. Mike works as a consultant for clients through his company Ember Silk. He develops across the stack with a particular concentration on the back end and database development. He was first featured as a guest on Underserved way back in season 1, episode number 7. Mike and I have been discussing the impact of generative AI quite a bit recently, and he's been using the tools extensively since late last year. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Eli Goldberg is the former VP of Applied Data Science for Current Health, a Best Buy company. We first featured him on episode 69 of Underserved. Eli holds a doctorate and a master's from ETH Zurich in Switzerland. He served as Senior Director of Clinical Analytics at CVS Aetna, held scientific entrepreneurship positions at Novartis, and founded and exited several healthcare and data science startups. He holds several scientific advisory board positions for health tech companies in the U.S. and Australia. His concentration on healthcare solution offers a unique perspective in a field where people are both excited by and frightened of innovation from generative AI. Eli, welcome back to Underserved.
Thanks for having me back, Andrew. Pleasure to be here again.
Steve Coffer was the co-founder and CEO of TripAdvisor for over two decades. In his tenure there, he grew the company from a startup to a multi-billion dollar company, with hundreds of millions of users all sharing reviews and opinions on millions of accommodations, restaurants, experiences, airlines, and cruises. Today, Steve invests in and advises several companies and has been a vocal fan of ChatGPT. Steve, thank you for joining us again on Underserved.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest Rachel Rosen pioneered groundbreaking ideas in artificial intelligence and cybernetics back in the 1980s. She has experience working with all sorts of systems in the robotics industry. Recently, she has become fluent in ChatGPT as a prompt engineer and is keen to see how AI can help further the singularity, the merging of humans and computers. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on Underserved, Andrew.
So actually, Steve, we're going to kick it off with you. I wanted to ask you, how do you think differently about software development since seeing ChatGPT from kind of a product design and architecture perspective?
I really think it's going to be completely changing the way most software development happens. And so you have so many different aspects. You've got developers writing code for other users, and ChatGPT today and the Microsoft Copilot and all this stuff can help build the framework. They can create simple programs for you. The code completion is really pretty amazing. It can do some rudimentary error checking, you know, looking through the code, trying to find stuff already. And this is literally like 6 months after it's first been released to the world. So just wait and see how good it gets. I don't think it's going to be great at architecture. Hey, do you want a three-layer system? What's your back end going to look like? Where are you deciding to store this stuff? But that's what makes great software engineers. They make the right decisions there. But just getting a lot of the raw coding done, using technology to help you debug it before you actually run it the first time, I think that's going to be amazing. That's sort of for the software developer writing something that's going to go out to the world. Then you have a tremendous amount of software that's being written every day for internal purposes. And we can talk about like report writing and data analysis and internal gathering of the data. And I think ChatGPT is going to rock on in that sort of area.
How pervasive do you think this will be with developers? Like, what do you think the adoption rate's going to be?
I will be on record today, 80% of developers within a year will be using Copilot or something similar to be more productive, if not 90%. I just cannot imagine what the developer's doing that has no bearing on being able to be helped with a productivity tool. It covers any language. It covers any type of development. Near as I can tell, it's pretty awesome.
Mike, let's hear your take on that. What would you say is kind of a sweet spot for AI, for software developers in particular?
It's the perfect pair programmer. That's exactly what it is. So they had the idea 20 years ago. Now it's come to fruition. For all the reasons that a pair programmer has an advantage over just an isolated programmer, it's a sounding board. It can do a lot of the typing for you. It's just remarkable.
It never gets tired.
Nope.
It never gets too critical of you, or, you know, you're probably not going to take offense to it. Or
no, it's a force multiplier for programmers. It's not going to take someone that doesn't know how to code and allow them to take someone's job. And it's certainly not in a place now where it could replace a good programmer 100% because of all the mistakes it makes. But if you have an idea of what you're doing, and you just need this to push you along, or again, between these two tools to just write a lot of the code for you. A lot of the mistakes that it makes, it's casting errors and things like that. So you can pick them up pretty quickly, but you still need to know what you're looking for. It's really a pair programmer. And that's really the use case for now. And that's really the limit of the use case. Because everyone, just like 2 years ago, everybody needed a blockchain strategy. Everybody needs a generative AI strategy right now. And so OpenTable, which I use a lot, sent an email probably in January that they were adding ChatGPT functionality to it. And so I thought that was interesting. And what they said they were going to do is that they were going to update the app to allow you to say what type of occasion that you were going to have. Like, is it an anniversary? Is it a graduation? Like, things like that. And it would recommend a restaurant. Now, my experience using this, it could recommend a restaurant that doesn't exist is part of the problem. And so as far as being integrated into an application and just having it render an answer to someone that doesn't understand that this is a large language model with its drawbacks, it's just not usable at this point. I just don't see how you could possibly do that. So again, just like your pair programmer, even if they're superhuman, they're going to make mistakes, right? And anything that they tell you, you need to be like, hey, wait a minute, maybe you didn't understand that, or wait, that's not going to work. You need to have that layer of interaction with it and understanding, and embedding it into apps just isn't going to work right now because it just makes stuff up. I'll tell you, like, again, like back with the cutting and pasting, like I can take a menu, like a PDF, Control A, Control C, Control V into ChatGPT and be like, hey, is there anything interesting on this menu that I might not find anywhere else? And it will tell you, which is remarkable. And it will say, oh, because this duckling is prepared this way, that sounds delicious. And this, and will that go well with French onion soup? Absolutely. I'm like, okay, this is great. And I'm like, oh, I just wish they had key lime pie. Oh, they do have key lime pie. It's really well reviewed. And I go back and look at the menu. No, they don't. Like, where'd you get that? Oh, I apologize.
Let's hear from Eli on that one as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to take this from a bit of a healthcare perspective because that's sort of where I live. There's a lot of things that I think are ripe for AI in general, but I also want to make a clear distinction between machine learning and AI, which I'll bundle as AI, and then the generative side of AI and sort of what's emerged from this large language side. The use cases, I think, in general for AI outside of the generative space, more in the sort of classic regression and classification approaches. There's a ton, and that's what I've done for a really long time. On the generative side, I think there's a lot of opportunities that I think we think of as tricky problems that I think will be solved. So number one in my book is like scheduling. So if you ever have any workforce optimization problems, you're trying to schedule nurses, you're trying to schedule doctors, you're scheduling shifts, you want a patient to come in at the right time, you want a nurse to arrive at your house, all of these things are a really tricky optimization problem of calendars and lives. You know, I really think that scheduling is one area which is like such an easy, low-hanging fruit. There's always been a lot of opportunity in the scheduling space, but it's just a hard problem, right? Like even time zones. Like if you've ever talked to a seasoned programmer and you're like, hey, what do you think about managing time zones between Europe and the US? And they're going to be like, yeah, I hate you. Like that's really hard and I don't like doing it. And there's this weird calendar and I don't get it, you know? And so if you think about that and international business and you overlay this just like dance everybody does about, hey man, I can do between 2 and 3. No, I got a softball game. I got to pick up my kid. You know, there's a million things that are going on. Ultimately, scheduling is a conversation. And I think that we'll find that that's a really good use case. In the healthcare world, I think there's a lot of other use cases that I think are really a dramatic shift, I hope, in the way people think about work. So when you go to the doctor, what's the first thing you do in America? Right? Let's constrain this conversation to the like dystopian apocalypse that is like the American healthcare system. But you get your insurance information, right? You go to the front desk, you might have a copay, like you've got all this like weird paperwork to do before you're like, hey man, can you just like look at my throat? I'm dying over here. You've got strep throat, I think, you know, and I know because I went to ChatGPT and I put in all my symptoms and it told me. I think we'll find that the generative models are a really effective way to do pre-visit summaries, to condense information for physicians to focus on clear problems. When I think about like nursing and triage, I don't want to be insensitive to the need for nurses. I think nurses are super critical. I think we have a nurse shortage, we have a physician shortage, and I don't think these things are going to get easier. And part of those shortages are about training times and the pandemic and a million other stuff. Another big reason is burnout. So you've got doctors and nurses who like a significant fraction of their job are administrative. And so if you can take away some of that administrative burden, I think the quality of life for physicians and nurses, the business of caring for people can shift in some positive ways. No more triage, you know, no more looking for like insurance information or like having to explain benefits. I think that some of those things will be good. Even things like within visit, after visit summaries, and just kind of like grokking what's actually happened in the visit. If you watched a movie in the last 20 years where someone gets diagnosed with like cancer, what do they portray in the movie? You know, hey, you've got cancer. And all of a sudden it's this ringing in their ears. They don't understand what the doctor's saying, but actually that's like the most critical moment when you need to pay attention. And so just making sure stuff doesn't slip through the cracks. There's some non-de minimis fraction of prescriptions that get misprescribed purely from doctor's handwriting. It's in the single digits, but like it's a non-trivial fraction of misprescriptions. So there's a ton of opportunities that generative work can go from maybe speech and interaction to understanding and comprehension to summarization and understanding. There are other areas that I think are really going to be dramatically enhanced, not necessarily by like, let's say the chatbot approaches, but simply from the architectures, these large transformer architectures. So if you look at something like ICD codes, which is this like international classification of diseases, not only have they changed throughout time, I think we're on the 10th and like soon to be 11th version of these codes, but there's like 70, 80,000 of these things. And so if you think about that diversity and you think about how we use these codes, all payers use these codes to predict risk. You've got providers who are doing it to predict and make sure that they're getting as much as they can. I mean, it's a billing system. It's a way to enable billing. But you know, there's a beautiful time series of information in these ICD codes. And the way that language works is not so dissimilar to the time series of ICD codes. So I anticipate that some of the same architectures and frameworks that we're using now to do natural language processing are really a hop, skip, and a jump away from trying to understand disease in a much more robust way.
Let's hear from Rachel on that one as well. Do you have any use cases that are a sweet spot for using AI in software development?
Certainly. AI can be a valuable tool in software development. I am personally a big fan of test-driven development. AI can be used to automate testing processes by generating test cases, detecting bugs, and analyzing code coverage. AI algorithms can analyze code repositories, bug databases, and user feedback to identify patterns and predict potential bugs or areas of code that require attention. AI can help analyze and optimize code performance, often in ways that humans could not foresee. There have been some recent articles that Mike mentioned on the pre-call surrounding improvement in sorting algorithms. It can also help identify bottlenecks in code, where we used to have to write a lot of scaffolding and trust code to figure this out.
Eli, you know, you've been a big practitioner of ChatGPT since last November. You got me into it, actually, reading your LinkedIn posts about it. What useful tools have you discovered since then, and how do they kind of help you every day?
That's a personal victory for me. Thanks for giving me the credit for that. The tool landscape is dramatically expanding. And in some ways, I'm a little nervous about it, but I'll kind of go over a couple of the tools that I really use sort of every day. First, I have some long-term running threads on ChatGPT. I think GPT-4 is a really remarkable model. I think that this profound creation of real capabilities that has emerged in this last generation of models has been like really remarkable. And I have a couple of threads going on ChatGPT that I effectively have personas. So I've got like threads where I'm asking ChatGPT critical knowledge in which the history of that thread is really important. So, you know, I have one that's just a senior level Python developer and machine learning expert. I have one that, you know, is seeded with an understanding of ICD codes and the relationships between disease states and their theoretical manifestation claims data. You know, I have others which are really good at visualization in terms of saying, hey, I need to turn this code into an animated plot in this software or that software. And so I've really started to develop a series of personas that I exist with as like really close coding buddies or friends almost. It feels weird to say, but I'm going to say it, like friends, ChatGPT. The universe of tools is also expanding. So when I think about the stuff that I'm doing at a company level, I work in the healthcare field. GPT-4 is not a place where you want to put any healthcare information, right? So while I think they're pursuing, and I think maybe one company has signed a BAA, which is a document that allows you to sort of share HIPAA information with someone, a business associates agreement. The reality is I think it'll be a while before we see like really dramatically open and secure large language models that are sort of like public facing ones that are acceptable for PHI, PII, and secure data. And as a consequence, you know, there's been a lot of a diversity of models, mostly from like Facebook leaks, you know, the Llama model set, that have really dramatically pushed not only the state of the art, dramatically reducing the training volume, the corpus of data tokens effectively that these models are being trained on, but also new modalities of training. So I'm spinning up, you know, new models on Hugging Face and intersecting it with SageMaker. There's just like a really great sort of very clear path there. And having your own in-house behind your VPC large language models to play around with, even if they're like not as effective as GPT-4 and they're very good at maybe myopic tasks, has been really remarkable. I also use things like Midjourney, and sometimes it's for silly stuff like, hey, I need a picture of a purple-haired warrior, you know, XYZ, and I'm doing something for like Dungeons and Dragons and I just need like some inspiration. But I'm also, you know, I advise a handful of startups. I'm on a handful of boards. And, you know, if they're looking for content, you know, they want to run an Instagram campaign for a new t-shirt design or something like that. Hey, man, go to Midjourney, you know, like go, you know, make a t-shirt design, put it out there, like figure out if this works. And there's a lot of experimentation that I think, you know, these generative tools have really been helping with. There's a lot of other stuff that I've built that I use that, you know, from like a programming perspective where I'm integrating some of that workflow in public ways. So I use JupyterLab a lot as a sort of programming template. And there's a really great sort of plugin that allows you to use ChatGPT within a Jupyter notebook, which is great. But then once again, if I'm doing confidential stuff, which is like 99% of my life, it's not that useful. So it's useful for my side projects, but not that useful for day-to-day work.
So speaking of side projects, in the pre-call, you mentioned one that you described as a self-licking ice cream cone. Prompt Perfect? What's that about?
Yeah. So Prompt Perfect is a plugin for ChatGPT that I and a lot of other people got like early access to. Effectively, it's a way to create a better prompt. So you can imagine if the quality of your output is related to your input and you're having a conversation with a model, asking them or the model a very clear question that's like, hey, how would you make a better prompt? Or like, let's design a prompt. It's sort of like a prompt builder. And it feels like a metaphorical loop, right? Like, why would that work? You know, like, let me just like bang in here this like weird prompt. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. But actually, people often forget that the way these models work, it's not humans. And like small changes in your diction, small changes in the way that you're constraining prose, clearly positioning some templating, like Prompt Perfect doesn't make the world's greatest prompts every time. But actually, like if you're just struggling for inspiration, it's a really effective way to the Pareto. Just like you will get 80% of the way there for 20% of the effort. But it's the self-licking ice cream cone, right? Like you're making a prompt to make a prompt. It's like, okay, cool. Like I'm going to have a meeting. You know, it just feels weird.
Yeah, but if it works, it's hard to argue with it.
True. That's true.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Marist Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's maris-cg.com.
Mike Bro, same question for you. What useful tools have you discovered in the past year or so, and how do they kind of help you every day?
So I use GitHub Copilot inside of Visual Studio Code, which I use for absolutely everything now. That is auto completion. You could think of it as IntelliSense, but IntelliSense on steroids. It's based on the same technology as ChatGPT, and it analyzes what you're typing in the code and then suggests more lines. And when I say more lines, it could be 50 lines. And it is incredibly useful because it turns out that everyone writes the same boilerplate code. And it knows that once you define a variable called username, the next variable is probably going to be a password. And also, if you're in an API, that you're going to have some login method. And it does all those things. But unlike, say, Google searches, where it needs to exist exactly before it can return you the result, it is generative, just like ChatGPT, where it caters the answer to your code style and exactly what you're doing. So that allows you to type maybe a 20th of what you would normally type, because it's almost always right. And so that allows you just to blast through things much, much faster once you have an idea of what you want to do.
Sounds much easier on the wrists too. Besides Copilot and ChatGPT, are there other things? Are you working directly with the APIs of OpenAI? Or?
Yep, they also have an API that you can make calls from Python. And so you can do some automation with that. One of the things it's exceptionally good at, aside from just the coding, is summarizing information. As someone that used to do a lot of screen scraping back in the day, let's say from an article, it can be difficult to get what is actually the article text as opposed to the headers and the footer and the sidebar and all those things. I could go to a page right now on CNN.com and cut and paste that into ChatGPT and just say, what's this about? And it will tell me. It's able to ignore the noise. Similarly, you could take a spreadsheet and just cut and paste it and be like, what is the spreadsheet about? And it will tell you. You can take a JSON file and just paste in the JSON, and it's smart enough to figure out what things are. Like, I did that once, and most of the arrays had 12 numbers in them, and it knew that I was doing something monthly without any context at all. So it's incredible for things like that. So I was trying to think of applications, and it's a great summarizer and a great unblocker. It really is an amazing sounding board, and to get you started or to get you unstuck, it's incredible. So one thing I was thinking about is, like, let's say a psychotherapist has an application. So you put in all your patient information, just the background about the person, and then there's notes about each visit. And then there's a quantitative scale too, just on a 1 to 10 scale, how you think they're doing. So I built this in Python and React, of course, using Copilot and ChatGPT to help me crank that out. And it made up some fake patients for me. And I put in that data and then I answer a bunch of notes and I'm like, okay. I then call the API and I have a button on in the app that says summarize. And it hosts the information about the person's background as well as all the notes. And the prompt that I gave it was, all right, this is the information about this. I'm having a problem like moving ahead. I was wondering if you could recommend some treatments specific to this patient. And it recommends them, all of which makes sense. And then I actually added another filtering layer. Once I got a bunch of data and I had a bunch of the treatments that it asked about, I then made those hyperlinks in the response that came back. I processed that in the Python. And then if you click on any of those, it drills down and then gives a response about exactly how you would perform that treatment with a given patient. So that seems like a real world application, again, to get people unstuck. And so that's one thing. The other thing that it does incredibly well is be creative. And so I think a lot of what people have seen, at least initially what I saw the first time, was just people asking it to write stories in different styles of filmmakers or authors. And so another thing I did using the API was just set up a structure where I could make a bunch of character bios and then a plot, and then I start to write the chapter. And I post all that to the API and then tell it that I want it to write to continue this in a sensible fashion, and I want this to be 1,000 words. And it will come back and write the next section of my book. And then I can either iterate, you know, and then we iterate on that, and then we just move forward. Doing that over one weekend, I ended up with a 44,000 word sword and sorcery novel. It needs a lot of work, but it's pretty remarkable as far as that goes.
Rachel, what are your thoughts? Are there any use cases where you think AI is not ready to help us?
There are some areas where AI does not shine, at least not yet. AI currently does not possess the creativity and intuition required for tasks such as UI, UX design, graphical design, or the artistic aspects of software development. These areas usually require human expertise and aesthetic sensibilities. The other not-ready-for-prime-time area is where high-stakes decisions need to be made, such as architectural design choices, security protocols, or legal compliance. In these areas, human judgment and expertise are preferred over relying solely on AI models. Human decision-making is vital to consider the ethical, legal, and social implications that AI may not fully comprehend.
Rachel, can you tell us a story of when generative AI failed you in software development? And If so, how did you recognize it was lying? How did you fix it?
Oh, Andrew, I have a good story about that. I was using some automated code generation and was under a deadline to deliver. I noticed that the generative AI was providing inconsistent and unreliable code snippets. The generated code would compile without errors, but it produced incorrect outputs that caused my application to crash. At first, I doubted my own code and started debugging the application extensively. I became more frustrated and confused when my code seemed to be correct. I posted some snippets on a Reddit forum and got some good feedback from the community. One of the clues they gave me led me to dive deeper into the generated code. I was able to narrow the scope of the problem and then reproduce it consistently and identified the problematic lines. I then had to make sure that the AI did not regenerate the error, so I locked down that part of the code and would only let it generate a small and unrelated chunk at a time. This helped me fence in the problem.
Eli, same question for you.
Yeah, it fails all the time. You know, like honestly, like it is not a super intelligence. I think folks who use it a lot realize it. I've asked it sort of questions that are like very information retrieval-y, like, hey, what's the most populous country, not Mexico and South America? And like, it'll get it wrong. But I think like questions like that, there's some complexity in the wording, but I think that's a narrowing definition of like failure. Because I think as these models get better, as more edge cases, more engineering sort of comes into play and control of large language models in general, I think we'll see some of those go away. On the other hand, like if you're trying to understand sequential logic, there's also a lot of failures. So sometimes you can ask it like, hey, get me from point A to point B and it'll write out the steps and like A will be right, B will be right, like C will be like, who, like what is that? And D will be like, yeah, like I was talking about spaghetti. You're like, it's blankets and pineapple over here. Like it's unclear where like the connection between these steps. And that's a new modality of the way that they're training these models. So they're going to go through and update these models to do like stepwise learning. If you go and you look at like Khan Academy, that's what they're doing, is they're really adding sort of step-by-step like process improvements. But there's also things that just come out wrong. So on my ChatGPT thread where I'm asking it to be an ICD expert with an understanding of certain disease states, it will create provider codes and CPT codes. Wow, they look real. They're like definitely formatted like how they would be, but they're definitely not right. There's also a lot of like logic failures as well. You know, thinking a little bit about bias and thinking a little bit about how the questions are answered. Like sometimes it's like, no, that's a really bad answer. And part of me is like heartened by that because like I have fairly specialized knowledge and like my knowledge gives me an opportunity to correct that or to know where the failures are. But the, let's say, marginal value of intelligence is decreasing because it's not that wrong. And if I update that prompt, and it retrains it and it's weighted enough to be able to like influence it the next time a similar question comes about. You know what? Like maybe my specialist knowledge won't be so valuable. Interestingly, you know, I think the way that I deal with it, like I'm shockingly nice to this model. I don't know if it's like I want to be a robot or like I just grew up, you know, just be kind to everything. I treat this thread like a person. You know, I've got all these personas and I've like named them. That's not weird or anything, but my Python programmer is definitely this Ukrainian guy from my PhD who was just like brilliant. I was like, yeah, this is you. You know, like I kind of feel like if it doesn't give me a good answer, it's on me. And there's kind of an interesting Socratic approach there in that if the name of the game is ask good questions, I feel like it's functionally teaching people how to ask better questions.
I think you're being nice to the bots in case they take over someday.
Yeah, that too. I didn't want to say that. Now they know.
My wife is always super polite to Alexa to the point where I'm like, huh, oh, please, thank you, this and that. I'm like, wow, that's very nice. When they take over, they'll spare you.
I'm sure I'll be turned into like a Duracell battery or whatever. But I also feel like I get better answers. There's an interesting study that happened. The study actually used a subreddit called Ask a Doc. And the subreddit is filled with, no surprise, people desirous of like questions to be answered by physicians. And on the other side, there are physicians who are answering these questions. And so in the study, they had ChatGPT respond to these questions. And it was a curated response in terms of they put in the input and then, you know, expected an output. But the response was overread by physicians. And then they evaluated the responses in comparison to real doctors who were spending their after-hours time responding in this subreddit. And hands down, ChatGPT was more compassionate, right? Like the empathy of responses was just way better. And actually, a lot of the information was better. The physicians tended to be brief, very fact-based, but like the vernacular that they use to get things done is not the same vernacular that you would typically use to communicate with a patient. So I'm not really sure if this says more about who doctors are these days or, you know, like how we're selecting for physicians in terms of that sort of training process. But look, ChatGPT doesn't get tired, doesn't get angry. You know, it's got clear constraints on how to respond. But if you're mean to it, I'm pretty sure like when that like long token, like memory length increases and these vector databases individually get really long, that they'll be scraped and humans will be culled in the coming apocalypse. So on the margin, I'm trying to be nice.
Mike, what are your thoughts? How and why does it just lie or make stuff up or just miss like that?
So the hallucinating is the big issue where it's going to take them before. So we need to think about what this is and how it works. And so the GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. Previously, when it was going to take an input, it would read it like a human sequentially. And apparently in that, when you had a large document, it had a difficult time keeping track of things as far as weights go about what's important. And so it would really heavily favor things at the end. This transformer uses what's called an attention mechanism. And the attention mechanism analyzes the whole document at the same time. It looks at every word in the document and takes a correlation between every two words. It also is really just a brain that they allow to store information. So they have the attention mechanism, but how it actually weights the words and decides what to generate for the document isn't easily interpretable by humans. And here's why. Whatever you had for breakfast today, there were some decisions that were made in a model that you had in your head about what to pick for breakfast. So Google PageRank is another example I think a lot about because this is kind of like search, but with the generative aspect to it. When I learned about SEO, the Google PageRank algorithm had 200 parameters. Those were generated by humans. If you typed in a search term, a human could explain why the first result came back. Now, going to large language models, its evaluation is what's the next word that I should put in the response? Now, that's not exactly accurate because it does use functions and multiple files for coding, so it can't just be the next word solely, but that's really what it was designed for. And so when they train it, they give it a capacity to generate these parameters to then generate this response later. The model for ChatGPT 3.5 stores 175 billion parameters with correlations that humans can never understand. The engineers look at it and it doesn't make any sense because we just can't possibly fathom how it derives those equations and weights for the parameters. That's the long answer, but the answer you get based on that is the reason why it hallucinates. They don't know. No one knows. And so you can try and force it to adjust the parameters in a way that you feel is better. So they do what's called supervised learning, which it generates three responses and they tell which one is the right one. And then it tweaks the parameters based on that. But you can't force it to do anything.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem, though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hi, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx.
Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Maris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Maris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Maris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers, to project managers, to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Maris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Maris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com. Steve, I wanted to ask you this question. Do you see a danger from like a lock-in with a generative AI provider? Like, for example, you know, there's a bunch of clouds out there and you might start on Amazon, but you would have the option of moving to a Google Cloud or an Azure. It'd be expensive, but you can do it. But it kind of seems like ChatGPT is the game in town right now. They might be able to change their pricing or terms or access or even reuse your data. What would you do if you were engaging? Like, would you kind of bet the business on this, or how would you protect yourselves?
Yeah, great question. And I think the cloud analogy is probably a pretty good one. There was one leading cloud provider, and now you can kind of pick and choose, and depending on the features you want. And there's even some frameworks that allow you to program once and kind of run it anywhere that are emerging several years after the cloud business got to be pretty big. I think the model's going to work out the same in ChatGPT land or generative AI. ChatGPT certainly seems to be the furthest along, but I wouldn't bet my business on that versus what Google has or versus what some other flavors may be that might just better suit your particular needs. Less hallucinations, more grounded in facts. If I were a business looking to build, I would just keep really good records of what I am using this engine for, what of my own data sets I'm training the engine on, making sure to the degree that I can that my information is staying in my data set, not being shared with kind of the rest of the world. I can't imagine a business kind of loading up their data for the rest of the world to be able to get to, just like, yeah, no way. So this is my kind of private version. And if the company remembers what it trained the engine on, then yeah, if you do switch from GPT to Bard to something else, then you can go through that retraining process and it'll, I think, be somewhat similar to moving between cloud vendors. Like, I'm super impressed with GPT, but I don't have a particular thesis that says they have such an advantage that as a particular business, I wouldn't choose to switch to something else in 2 years down the road. This stuff is evolving so quickly. So absolutely get started, pick one. Not even sure it matters which one terribly right now, but at least you want the option to switch in a year or two.
Well, as engineers, we love a good abstraction layer.
Exactly.
It reminds me of like private cloud. You want private brain. I want one just for my company. I own what's in it, and I'm not letting other people see the data it's trained on or get use of what it figures out. Those insights are mine. That makes sense. From a convenience perspective, I like the idea of like a Siri meets Evernote meets my CRM meets everything I've written to be a better memory than I have and be a prompter for me. I imagine if someone builds that, they probably make it free, but they're harvesting your data, or maybe a freemium model. Like, what would you be comfortable with?
I think you're right. There's a freemium model that might get you a certain amount or half the features. Maybe they let you keep the data private, but you know, there's always going to be some hook. And I think that's a wonderful way to get people hooked on things. And then if you ask me, would I pay $20 a month to have something help me? Absolutely. Would I pay $100 a month for a personal assistant on my business side and my personal side that would remember all the things that I'm supposed to do? And I love Evernote and scanned all of my Evernotes. I use Google Docs all the time, scanned all my Google Docs so that I could just ask it questions rather than go looking for the information. Scans my email. If I trusted it, I would happily pay $100 a month for it. And it needs to be on my phone. It needs to be with me wherever I am, etc. But I think there's a nice set of businesses that will grow up around that.
All right, folks, you heard it here. $99 a month. Get her going. I think for portability purposes and for legal purposes, a lot of people are going to train their own little private cloud and have a manifest of what went into it. And, you know, be it in case someone says, hey, that's my stuff in there, they can point to, no, it's not. We trained it with this and we can retrain it if we have to move from ChatGPT to Bard or whatever. Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great point, too, as far as what happens to the data that you share. Because a lot of companies have outlawed using ChatGPT because they don't want people to paste the code into ChatGPT because they use that data to train the model in some ways. Maybe not incrementally update that model, but in preparation for future training or different models, say. Now they said they don't do that anymore. I don't really know the deal. But yeah, it will be commoditized, though, because, again, it's public. And some people have proven that you can use a much smaller model. You can do what's called fine tuning. I think somebody did this like a few months ago. They used the OpenAI API and got 30,000 questions and responses and used that to train a model. And based on that, they were able to get like a 17 million parameter model to function much higher because the answers were so good because they got it from ChatGPT. And that's something like I actually ran a model like that on just, I don't even have a video card. I just have it embedded on my Mac and you could do it. And so, yes, exactly that. People host their own. They might not be as efficient, but it will be private. And there are ways to get better efficiency from a smaller model that won't require that type of hardware.
So the age-old question, will this obsolesce developers and put them out of a job, or does it just make the 10x developer even better and the 1x developer get some more X's?
The former. If you're an A player already, it's a force multiplier, and it's not to the point now where it will replace programmers completely. Like, it's not like you don't need a programmer to write this, but you definitely could have a smaller team. Like, let's say that you had, you know, 3 A players and 10 junior developers. You might not need many of those people now. But yeah, for all the reasons that I talked about, it's not close for being able to replace everyone. So between the context limits that it can't look at that much code, its desire for creativity at some points, which is detrimental, it's far away from being able to replace developers completely. A machine will not take your job, but you know who will? Someone that knows how to use the machine better than you.
Rachel, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't see artificial intelligence completely replacing software developers. The role of AI in software development is not to replace software developers, but rather to enhance their capabilities and improve their efficiency. While AI can automate certain tasks and assist in code generation, it cannot fully replace the creativity, critical thinking, and problem-solving skills that human developers bring to the table. Software developers possess domain-specific knowledge and contextual understanding that goes beyond code. They consider factors such as user experience, business requirements, and the elusive common sense. AI-powered tools can assist developers in code generation, testing, and debugging, ultimately increasing their productivity and efficiency. AI can also aid in knowledge discovery, suggesting best practices, and analyzing vast amounts of code and documentation. It can provide developers with insights and recommendations to improve their code quality and performance.
I remember the 1980s when the robots were starting to show up on auto assembly lines, and they were like, oh, these are going to take human jobs. And now the bots are coming for the white-collar jobs. Eli, what are your thoughts on that?
How wild is that, right? Like, if you've ever been in a factory, these are not low-skilled jobs. These are low-pay jobs sometimes, which is like kind of a class issue. But I thought that like these low wage jobs were going to be the jobs that were automated. No, like there's automated data science work that can be done in ChatGPT. It's good and it's fast. Accounting, like taxes, right? Like what a great opportunity for generative AI, right? Is to like have a conversation about your taxes that like makes it a little smoother to go through the forms and fill things out. I mean, I think that's a really great opportunity. It's going to be strange, right? We think of businesses as maybe like the first super intelligences that we have. And so naturally, when we think about, hey, will AI be a super intelligence, and comparing it to like some of the other super intelligences that we may sort of already have, a business is an interesting one. Businesses is, if you've ever been in one, like they're fairly inefficient. I hope that businesses in general make better decisions than a single person would and are able to, you know, attack more targets and achieve some success in the market. But like being in a big company or even a small company, like it is wrought with inefficiency. The question is that inefficiency part of the nature of work? Is it part of what we view as comfortable? If it was brutally efficient and only about the capital accumulation, would it still function the same? I don't know. So like, I feel like there's also another angle here of, you know, will we see the first $1 billion single person company? Will we see a dramatic decrease in the total number of people per business, but will it be offset by the total number of businesses? That has implications everywhere. I mean, think about it from like a healthcare perspective, right? If you need less than 10 people to unicorn, look, you don't even have to offer insurance for less than 15 people in most states. You know what I'm saying? Like, so, you know, there's some fundamentally strange things I don't think we're ready for. In terms of will it like obsolete developers, I think not in the short term. I think there's a long-term undersupply of software. Like if you go to any tech company, any healthcare tech company, they'll tell you like, hey, we have like 20 years of backlog. And hammering through that backlog and that feature space, I think the expectations from a client side will change in terms of delivery. But actually, I think in the short term, you know, this long-term undersupply needs to be paid down. And every year, we've been paying it down, right? Every year, there's a long laundry list of things that get a little bit easier and of services that we were attacking. And the definition of roles was, and skill sets were like shrinking, right? Like, I mean, think about like the early days of cloud computing when like spinning up an EC2 was like a new thing, getting all the permissions management and things and yada, yada. And now like you can auto provision, auto scale, auto do these things. You can do it in Terraform in 15 minutes.
Steve, I wanted to get your thoughts on the following. How would you look differently at hiring given ChatGPT? Would you specifically look for developers who can show they can leverage this? And kind of as a follow-up, how else do you think it might change the interview and selection process?
For engineers in particular, I've really had my most success looking for people who are curious, who are inquisitive, who want to learn, who want to be a sponge, who want to grow their careers, and who like shipping stuff. And so if I was interviewing someone today for an engineering job, and of course they had heard of ChatGPT, but had never played with it, boom, not going to talk to them. I'm like, interview's over at that point. Not because I care whether they're in love with generative AI or not, but my goodness, this is one of the newest, most exciting, interesting things that's come along. And this is an engineer telling me, oh, they don't care very much, or they're too busy to be curious about the hottest thing going on in our industry. I'd go further and say, hey, have you used Copilot? Have you asked GPT to write any software for you? The answer is no. I'm like, what the heck? You've got no curiosity bone in your body? I used to be an engineer and I've already had it write software for me. I'm just curious. I'm not putting that software into production, but this is what kind of you do for a living, let alone the third question of like, hey, have you used GPT in your day job to help you write some software, to look up an answer to a question? Or are you still doing a Google search? Or there's so many different ways that an engineer could explore. And I want to hire the engineer who says, I'm going to be way more productive if I can master this new technology than the engineer that's like, oh, well, I don't really trust that stuff is going to, I heard that it creates lots of mistakes and writes buggy code. I'm like, you may decide after experimenting with it a lot that you choose not to use it because for the type of software you're writing, there's too many, you know, software hallucinations. That's fine, but it better be off of your own experience. Otherwise, truly, it just violates the, hey, I like hiring curious people. And if you're not playing around ChatGPT, you're really missing something.
There's always some new technology that's the hot flavor of the month, you know, whether it's mobile phones coming of age or NFTs or XML back in the day. Like, where on the hype versus substance scale do you think that generative AI is?
Great question, because there really is so many different hype cycles that have come along. I would reckon the best analogy would be this first version of GPT is closest to that first iPhone. So there's a bunch of mobile phones, smartphones before the iPhone, but the iPhone triggered this revolution in the App Store, the fact that other people could make add-ons and it could do all this stuff and it could browse the internet, just opened up the minds. And now none of us can live without our smartphones. And not the smartphone I had pre-Apple, but the Apple Android type smartphone. Now you look at GPT and Bard and all these tools that have come out and it's like, oh my God, they're all open enough that you can add to it. You've got a bazillion companies starting up to tune AI to a particular area. Well, that's pretty equivalent to the App Store offering. You know, they have more than 100,000 apps now. So it's just, I really do think this is an amazing time. So on par, maybe even more impactful than the mobile phone in terms of business, but obviously mobile phone had a lot of impact on a lot of consumers over the years. The adoption cycle will also be a lot faster. And you've got all the big companies building the infrastructure to support meaningful AI changes going forward. And I would add to the folks that are listening that are worried that this advancement, unlike the mobile phone, carries with it sort of scary Armageddon type challenges, I would say, yes, there are some ways that one can misuse the capabilities, but it doesn't make any sense to slow down or kind of stop this technology. Humans don't have the ability to foresee where this is going to go in 5 years. And so regulate it if you need to, guide it maybe, but really let the companies spawn that are going to be using this for great purposes.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us again on Underserved.
Been my absolute pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
Mike Bro, thank you very much for joining us again on Underserved.
Well, thank you. That was fun.
Eli, it was great to have you back on the show as well.
Andrew, look, thank you so much, but I hope this was fun for me. This was great.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your insights and experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, I just wanted to say all of the folks at Tyrell Corporation are big fans of your podcast. We listen to it every week when it comes out. We even use it for training our AI model.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how to feel about that, but I am glad that you're all listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed our special 100th episode about the AI invasion. If you want to continue the conversation, feel free to email us at underserved@mariscg.com. That's underserved@mariscg.com. So thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you all soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Rachel Rosen. I am a fictional character named after a famous Nexus 6 replicant. I sound like an expert in artificial intelligence, but that's because my answers were all written by ChatGPT. Andrew tried out several text-to-speech engines, but ultimately, Fiverr gave the best results. Imagine a dystopian future where AI bots hire humans to read scripts for them. Coming soon to a theater near you.